Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, who is taking the war for the free world on the road this week. But I have the pleasure of this first segment speaking with Bing West, who is former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under Ronald Reagan, and who has spent the past decade plus on the ground with our troops overseas, written 8 books, and is an authority we can trust for how the war is being prosecuted and what we could almost certainly do better. Bing, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, there have been a few developments in Syria that I think are worth a little scrutiny. I am having my usual hard time finding much good news in them, but let's take a look and see first what's going on. The president announced he is deploying 250 more special operators into theater. Now, those are my people. Those are the folks I love, and I hate to underestimate the value of 250 special forces troops as force multipliers, as trainers, as everything else they can do. But that's an awful big theater, and I don't know that that's a significant deployment. What are your thoughts?
Well, clearly what we're going to do with the special operations forces is just occasionally put a jab into the face of the terrorists. And that's all the president intends to do. The president has no intention of doing anything in the Middle East except finishing out his next 7 months in office and leaving. That's all. That's it. And when you really look at Syria and Iraq, the biggest huge problem is twofold. First, we're on the wrong side because we really have aligned ourselves with the Shias. And the Shia under Iran are perceived by all the Sunnis in the region as being the ones on the offensive against them. That's the first big problem. And the second big problem is we don't know why we're fighting. And by that I mean, tell me again, what are we supposed to achieve in either Syria or Iraq? And the answer comes back, well, we want to put it back together again the way it was. Was when? Well, about 10 years ago. Well, who was in charge 10 years ago? Well, Assad. Whoa. So who was in charge in Iraq? Well, the Shiite government. So people look at us and say, number one, we're not serious about fighting. And number two, we have no real comprehension that the Middle East has changed and you never get back to that status quo that you had 10 years ago.
Well, Bing, I want to dig into something you said. We have, under President Obama, significantly aligned ourselves with the Shia, represented by Iran, Hezbollah, the Revolutionary Guard, Quds Force, and the Shia militias, which Iran supplies and runs, who have been some hellish. We were fighting them. The U.S. forces were fighting them back in the Iraq war itself, in OIF. And now we are operating alongside of them as they slaughter their way through the Sunni areas where ISIS operates. Is there any way that can turn out to be something other than a bloody and deadly occupation?
No. No, Jim, it can't. I mean, we're on the wrong side. And the big problem is that whoever the next president coming in, I don't know whether anyone will just tell that president, you know, we have to reevaluate what the heck we're doing from square one. We are out there on the battlefield, as you point out, with the Iranians and with the Shias bombing the Sunnis. Now, what's wrong with that? Well, you're never going to finish the war. This war can only finish when you have new states, and no one wants to admit it. Well, when this war is over, you're going to have 4 new states. You're going to have Assad and his Shiites holding on to part of Syria. We're never going to get rid of them. They're part of it. Then you're going to have the Kurds with a very large state, and you're going to have Baghdad and Iraq south of Baghdad as a separate state. And the last of the 4 states, you're going to have a Sunni state. You're going to have a Sunnistan in the middle that will be fractured and that will be poor for another two decades. But there's no way out unless you give the Sunnis their own state so that they can fight against the terrorists. Right now, we're telling them the terrorists are going to conquer you, or the Shia are going to conquer you. And that's untenable. So there has to be a breakup of the current state system. That has to happen.
Well, Bing, I actually couldn't agree with you more. And the Center for Security Policy published a book I helped write called Cut Down the Black Flag that calls for that. So I always enjoy finding someone who can see through the facade of a Shia-dominated Sunni region, which there was a possibility of a federal Iraq at one point in time. We left, and that fell apart. Rejuvenating that is not going to happen. So as you say, I thought self-determination was the way it should be. The Sunni areas deserve a state. The Kurds have earned one. They are our allies.
And they have their own state.
They have their own state. They do. And
no
everything other
them,
than you.
No have. One's going to take it away from them.
No.
They have their own flag. They have their own passport system. They have their own international airports. And they guard their own borders. They are a de facto state. We just won't recognize it. But, Jim, you're absolutely right. Until we tell the Sunnis, you can have your own state, we're not giving them any incentive to try to win this war against the terrorists.
And as you mentioned, they don't have oil resources. That area is the poorest of all of these. But wouldn't it be better to subsidize them and actually pay them for peace? I don't mind that. You know, there's something to that if what you get out of it is their help in taking down the caliphate. And I don't have a problem with that.
I would totally agree. The other thing that I will warn the listeners about, you're going to hear Mrs. Clinton saying, we need to construct a safe zone. Don't do it. A safe zone puts us into Syria on the defense, responsible for 4 to 6 million refugees, and it will become America's Palestine, and we'll be responsible for them for the next two decades. Do not get involved on the ground in the defense in this war protecting refugees, because then the refugees are owned by America. And that's the worst possible thing we could do.
I think you have nailed it right there. Let's talk about it. We're talking with Bing West, who has written numerous books, spent considerable amount of time on the ground in Iraq and with our troops in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Bing, what about the Russians? Now, you said Assad has to stay. That was Putin's rule. He decided that was going to happen. The Iranians decided that's going to happen. So we're going to carve off a coastal enclave for them and in that way get Putin's buy-in for this potentially?
Well, look, Putin is a punk and a bully who's been able to have his way because Mr. Obama and Western Europe won't stand up to him. So we cannot get him out now. He is part of the landscape now. There will be Russian forces with the Assad Shiite forces. I don't care what happens to Assad as an individual. That political entity is going to continue, and unfortunately Russia is going to continue to be in the Middle East. I don't see any way, Jim, that we can change that right now. I just don't see we can change it.
I think you state that quite clearly, and I don't think there's any way either. So now all we need is the UN and maybe Europe and some other folks to buy in. Is there any chance of that? I mean, not under Obama. He's not bold enough to make a move like this. But say we get a new leader, can they make that case and make it stick?
No, and therefore it's going to play out in slow motion over 10 years. But I'll tell you what the real problem is. The real problem is that our institutions, the State Department and the military, will be unwilling to go to the new president and say, Mr. President or Mrs. President, whoever the person is, it's not working, and it hasn't been working for 13 years. Neither of those institutions has the institutional courage to walk forward and say, we have been wrong. You see what I mean? They're locked into their position regardless of who the president is. So the president is not going to hear from his own institutions. This thing doesn't work. That's the frustrating thing, is the lack of honesty on the institutional level inside the U.S. government.
Well, unfortunately, that is the difficulty we have. We can change the top level, but it's very difficult, as you said, to move those entrenched bureaucrats, and many of them have their own agendas that don't always match with what the country should be. Folks, we've been talking with Bing West, author of 8 books, noted Marine and chronicler of our Marines' exploits. Fantastic stuff. Thank you, Bing, for those insights.
Thank you, Jim.
Up next, we'll be talking with Tom Nichols, who is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. This is Jim Hansen, and you are listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk this segment with Tom Nichols, who is professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and also author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to jump in with what was an earth-shattering event in the world of national security and foreign policy yesterday when presidential candidate Donald Trump laid out the most amazing prescription for world peace and strength and everything else yesterday. And as a big, giant Trump supporter yourself, I'm sure this put you at ease and left you comfortable, correct?
That was really fairly stated, Jim. Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah, it didn't put me at ease, and it shouldn't put anyone at ease. It was, as I described it yesterday in the New York Daily News, it was word salad. It was just more kind of throwing a bunch of slogans in a blender, listing a bunch of problems in the world, and then finishing it literally with phrases like, "And when I'm president, that'll change." There were no specifics, there were no policies, there were no details. It basically was a speech that said, the world's a mess, and when I'm president, it won't be a mess. And the thing that I really found striking about it, that's the way Barack Obama used to talk. You know, all we have to do to fix things is put me in the Oval Office, and then magically everything will work itself out. And I didn't believe it then, and I don't believe it now.
Yeah, I know. I noticed over the past 7 years, the oceans did not actually recede during Obama's presidency.
No.
And all right, let's dig in, though. Now, his main theme and the concept he laid out was America first. Now, that's two words. That's something I think there's a case to be made for. But what exactly did he mean by that? And did that piece of the word salad actually have any protein to it?
Well, you know, the problem with that phrase is that it means different things to different people. If you're young, if you're, say, an under 40 Trump supporter, all that says to you is, oh, great, he loves America, we're number one. But Trump is 70 years old, and his supporters are guys closer to our age, which is to say mature and experienced. And America first has a very specific meaning. That was the cry of the isolationist movement in the 1930s and early 40s, before World War II. And it's meant to push a button. It's meant to push an American isolationist button. And for younger people, it sounds like we're number one. But to the older people that Trump is also targeting, it has a very specific meaning of direct isolationism. And don't think our allies and our enemies didn't notice it.
And I think it's interesting, his main slogan, Make America Great Again, was Ronald Reagan's. He's borrowed now his foreign policy slogan from the paleo isolationists. And I think, though, there is an element that is appealing among, and I guess you could call him the Rand Paul wing of the Republican Party and some Democrats who think that we have been a little expansionist and tried to fix the world and consequently maybe screw the world, build a wall, make America great, and we'll hide here in Fortress America.
It's a perennial favorite because there are always people who don't understand that the United States presides over a system of global cooperation and trade that actually benefits most Americans. And I'll give you an example. When the average American, not even a Trump supporter, but the average American thinks that we spend 25% of our budget on foreign aid, when in fact, the real figure, as you and I both know, is less than one half of 1%. And most of that is to buy American goods made by American workers to then send overseas to other people. But if you ask people, they say, well, the hell with the world, the hell with foreign aid, the hell with all that stuff, because we're giving away a quarter. There are people actually who think that half the budget, about 10% of Americans, think half the budget is given to foreign aid, which is insane. But
it would be if it were true, but unfortunately it's not. Yeah.
If those low information voters, you know, get a hold of a phrase like America first, they say, finally, somebody's speaking to what I believe, even though what they believe is complete nonsense. But it's very powerful. It's a very powerful incantation. You know, why should I die, you know, for Germany? Why should I die for Japan? Why should I? And of course, nobody's being drafted. We're not the kind of global, you know, mass army that we used to be. But this is, you know, this is Trump. As you made a very good point. This is Trump going back, rummaging around in the barrel. Well, I'll take a little bit of Reagan and I'll take some paleocon stuff and I'll take some Pat Buchanan stuff.
because I don't think he ever expected to get this far, and I don't think he has any idea what he's doing.
That seems apparent in many of these cases. Folks, we are talking with Tom Nichols, who is a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College. Tom, one thing he did promise to do, though, is he's going to kill ISIS. Said this is one thing, they won't see it coming, but they're dead. Did you catch how he was going to make that happen?
I didn't catch how he was going to make anything happen. That bit about, well, I'm going to be unpredictable and I'm not going to tell them what I'm going to do. To me, that came across as, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I don't think he told us what he's going to do because I don't think he has any idea. But I think what people should try to reconcile in their minds is, how can the guy who just said, I'm going to get over there, I'm going to bomb the you-know-what out of ISIS, I'm going to kill their families, and then he backs up and says, but I'm totally against all of this constant war in the Middle East. It makes no sense. He can't square that circle. And in fact, at one point he said, and I'm very proud to say I was always against the Iraq war. Well, he wasn't. I mean, he was on record. It's in his book. He also supported President Obama's intervention in Libya. But, you know, when Trump talks, his reality is whatever he's saying at the moment. And unfortunately, that's true for his listeners, too.
Well, I think one of the things that he claims to be able to do is make better deals and do all these things. But as you mentioned, when you state initially that you're going to be America first, you're not going to be an interventionist, you've done exactly what he accuses Barack Obama of doing, which is telegraphing our moves and capitulating first. So you've hamstrung your own ability to be the great deal maker.
It's like walking into the car dealership and saying, all right, here's what I'm prepared to pay.
Right.
Well, yeah, you know, that car dealers love guys like that. I mean, when he talked about these deals, the deal with Russia, did you catch the part in the speech? Here's how I'm going to handle Russia. Some people think they won't be reasonable. I'll find out. I'll make a deal. And then he went off script, because if you look at the script he delivered to reporters compared to what he said, all it said was, you know, I'll make a good deal and we'll see. He went off script, and it'll be a great deal. Well, a great deal about what? He never told us. I'm going to make a deal. Is it about trade? Is it about nuclear weapons? Is it about NATO? What? He just says, you know, I'll make a deal with Russia and it'll all be okay. And I, unfortunately, for too many of his supporters, that's enough. They say, oh, okay, it's a good deal, because they don't ask the next question.
Yeah, which is how. And I think you nailed
or
it.
What?
Or what? And I think you, or why? And I think you nailed the fact that he is in many ways mimicking Obama's hope and change with a lot of unicorns and rainbows. It's just, it's a more nationalistic, hardcore, and I don't want to say tyrannical, but I don't think it's a mistake that he keeps talking about Russia. He had the Russians in the front row for his speech.
He admires Russia. He and Putin have a bromance going. I mean, Putin practically endorsed him, and he accepted that. You know, at the time I wrote, could you imagine any U.S. president running for office and saying, and by the way, the leader of the Kremlin thinks I'm awesome. But up until now, that would have been instant disqualification for anybody running for president. But Trump wears it like a badge because, again, I think a lot of his followers think that foreign policy is this kind of annoyance. And as you say, that's exactly the way the Obama administration dealt with it. The parallels between the Trump campaign and the Obama campaign are terrifying. I mean, they're both led by people that are totally devoted to their leader, who can do no wrong, who think foreign policy is, you know, somebody else's problem, and that all you got to do is put their guy in the office, and, you know, as you said about Obama, the seas will recede, or in Trump's case, you know, everybody will get the message that the new sheriff's in town and they'll all behave. This is purely magical thinking. And it's just so, it's childlike.
Well, Tom
Absolutely.
Nichols, professor of national security affairs at U.S. Naval War College, thank you so much for that insightful analysis.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Up next, we will be talking with Neil Bascom, New York Times bestselling author. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260. The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A new Government Accountability Office report provides a damning indictment of the U.S. government's dysfunction with respect to addressing and mitigating the vulnerabilities of the nation's electric grid. GAO found that no one seems to be in charge of that mission at the federal level, specifically addressing the threat of intense electromagnetic pulses, whether arising from enemy action or naturally occurring solar storms. Fortunately, state officials like Texas Senator Bob Hall are filling the leadership vacuum. He previously helped safeguard our strategic deterrent against EMP and is currently sponsoring a two-day summit in Austin to begin protecting his state's electric infrastructure. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has also said he's going to make securing his state's grid a high priority. Now is the time for him to translate that commitment into action and lead the nation in doing so. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and I'm joined this segment by Neil Bascom, who is a New York Times best-selling author, and specifically of a new book called The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb. Now, as a commando type myself, I am always interested in good stories of amazing missions. The raid on Entebbe was one of the most epic things ever. You had the great raid in the Philippines where we rescued the prisoners of war at Cabanatuan. But this one here, in an attempt to stop Hitler from building an atomic bomb, sounds pretty amazing and one I don't think enough people have heard about. So give us the basic idea here, Neil.
The basic idea is that the Germans needed an ingredient for their atomic bomb called heavy water. You have heavy water, you produce a reactor, you produce plutonium, you have a bomb. And the Allies knew it. They knew the location where the heavy water was being produced, about 100 miles west of Oslo in the Norwegian wild. And they decided in April of 1942 that they had to destroy this plant. They had to stop the Germans from getting heavy water. And this begins the series of operations, some that end in catastrophe, but others that are quite successful in hitting this place called Vermok.
Okay, so now the Nazis are aiming to get this, and obviously they had a lot of engineering and scientific projects underway, and had they brought them to fruition, we could be living in a much different planet. And I don't know that many folks are aware of the tremendous capabilities and the tremendous fight the Norwegians made, given their proximity to both Russia and Germany. They were a pivotal, I guess, almost crossroads for a large chunk of World War II. So tell us about what the Norwegian commandos actually attempted to do and accomplished.
So the Germans occupied Norway in 1940, and quite a few of the young Norwegians actually did everything they could to go by ship or however means to get to England to be trained to fight. And many of these commandos joined this company called Company Ling, which was this elite group that were specially trained by the British SOE. And for this operation against Vermuk, they parachuted back into their country, survived on this mountain plateau for months at a time. And really, this book is as much a story about beating the Germans as it is about surviving in nature and being in the spot at the right time to hit this plant. And, you know, over the course of many months, these guys lived in a single cabin in epic blizzards. Their sacrifices of their families was just remarkable, and they performed this amazing sabotage raid on this plant, climbed a 500-foot sheer cliff to reach it, and it was pretty amazing.
Now that, to me, should have already been a movie, and I think, you know, we've seen, you know, we've had Guns of Navarone, there are a lot of these stories that have already been told. It appears there's a possibility we may get to see this. If not, you know, I would definitely tell people to go ahead and read the book and get that story. It's called The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb. But do we have a chance of seeing this on the big screen?
So, yes, Paramount Pictures bought the rights to it, and Michael Bay is hopefully gonna make it. There was actually a movie almost 50 years ago called The Heroes of Telemark with Kirk Douglas that did a sort of very 50s version of this attack. It's worth seeing just for sheer comedy.
Sometimes some of the older films are a little earnest in their...
They're quite earnest.
Yeah.
But the true story is good enough. I mean, what I loved about this book and the research was, you know, there was nothing extraordinary about these guys when the war started. They were postmen and plumbers and clerks and in an office, and by the end of the war they were heroes, but they sacrificed a lot in the middle.
Now you mentioned that many of these folks trained in England, you know, they bailed as soon as they could get out. Are these guys part of that group, or how did they go from being postmen to parachutists and whatnot?
So they, you know, I'll give you an example of one, a man named Einar Schennerlund. He lived around the area where the plant was. He decided he needed a fight. He went to the coast. He hijacked a steamer ship and sailed it across the North Sea to get to England, arrived in England, and was brought in by a man named Leif Tronstad, who's really the hero of this story, a scientist turned spy master. And Tronstad sends him to training. Many of these individuals, the British SOE had a roughly 3-month training regime. The first month was basic training, the second month was commando training, and the third month was essentially spy training. And by the end of that course, they were very much ready. And what you have to understand, when these guys started, they were tough guys, as it were. They may have been postmen, but they were survivalists, hunters. And
they were Norwegian postmen.
They were Norwegians. Absolutely.
And I can identify with that. My entire family is Swedish, so I think there is that element. And as soon as you mentioned the guy hijacks a boat and takes it to England, he's pulling Viking operations right there, is what that guy's up to. He's reaching back into the past.
No, he absolutely is. I mean, I was told the story of one of these guys by the family member. When he was 11 years old, he would go out into this mountain plateau, a place that was, legend had it, got so cold so fast, froze in the fire. And his parents would say, you know, we'll see you in 3 or 4 days. And he and his friends would just go out, ski, camp, hunt by themselves, you know, barely out of, their knee socks.
You know, you just hit me right where I live. We did winter training one time. I was Army Special Forces. We did winter survival training high up in the mountains in Montana one time. And the wet bulb thermometer temperature was negative 63 degrees, not the wind chill. And the story you just told about the flames freezing, we built a fire. We built a chest high roaring fire, and you couldn't feel the heat until you touched the flame itself. You could look at it, right? And you got a little comfort from the fact that there was a fire in front of you, but you could not feel any heat from it until you actually touched the flame and burnt yourself. It's I guess I feel for them in that range, and I think they're magnificent. to have done that. Folks, we're talking with Neil Bascom, who is a New York Times bestselling author. We were talking about his book, The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb. Can we shift gears to another one that seems to be coming up, also World War II focused, called The Grand Escape? And this one, I guess, like, let's go back one more war, I apologize, to World War I. World War I pilots escaping from a German prison? Tell us about this one. This is another one I don't think enough folks have heard about.
So this is the story I'm just in the beginning stages of researching. It's called The Grand Escape. It's a story of these RFC, the Royal Flying Corps pilots, these rudimentary planes, this early Air Force. And these guys, you know, were daredevils as it was. The average lifespan in that corps was about 17 hours in the air. And many of them were shot down and survived over German territory, were captured. And they were inveterate escape artists. I mean, you just couldn't keep these guys in. And so essentially the Germans sent them to a camp called Holzminden, which was kind of the Alcatraz of Germany at the time. And the story of the book that I'm hoping to write, I will write, is about how they managed to survive and how they escaped.
So they sound like a similar type bunch, you know, the adventurers, the crazies, because there really was no established flying, especially military flying, prior to this happening, you know, as it occurred in World War I. Where did they come from? Were they, again, just the crazy, fun, adventurous cowboys who took this up because it was, you know, a way those folks are driven?
Yeah, I mean, they were scattered. Many of them were British of origin, but they were living in South America or South Africa or Canada or Australia or New Zealand. They were sort of scattered all over the place. I mean, what I love about these books and what I, you know, same with the Winter Fortress is trying to examine, you know, what these individuals are fighting for, why they're fighting, how they're able to do what they do. And it's those kind of stories that fascinate me.
Well, they fascinate a lot of us, and we greatly appreciate your telling the stories and allowing the rest of us to share in them and make sure they aren't forgotten, because these sacrifices and these type of folks need to be heard. Once again, we've been talking with Neil Bascom, author of The Winter Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb. Thanks again, Neil. We look forward to seeing, hopefully, that on the big screen.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Up next, we will be talking with Michael Anderson about immigration. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. in an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about civilization jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization. The Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Every year, more American adults die from vaccine-preventable diseases than from breast cancer, traffic accidents, or AIDS. Vaccines like the one for pneumococcal disease can protect adults from illnesses that can cause missed days of work, hospitalization, and even death. Pneumococcal disease is an infection that can lead to pneumonia, meningitis, or even a severe blood infection. That's just one example of an infection that can spread from person to person. Getting vaccinated can help protect you and those close to you. I'm Dr. Susan Rehm of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. When I speak with my patients, I urge them to get all their recommended vaccines. Now I'm urging you to speak with your doctor to find out which vaccines you need. For more information about the vaccines that are recommended for adults and the diseases they prevent, like HPV, whooping cough, tetanus, and shingles, visit adultvaccination.org. That's www.adultvaccination.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We are talking right now with Michael Anderson, a retired U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer who now writes on politics and blogs at the Western Free Press. Michael, I wanted to talk to you about a security issue that maybe national, but I think is a little bit closer to home. I think all security starts at home, and I think it was enshrined in our Constitution with the Second Amendment and with an expectation that all of us are responsible for our own safety and in some way, shape, and form the security of the nation as a whole. One of the political candidates who has, I think, done as much damage to that as she would ever be able to do good for it is Hillary Clinton. And let's start with her stance on gun control. She seems to believe that the American people can't be trusted with their own security and with the weapons they need to do that.
Absolutely. Great to be with you, Jim. I couldn't agree more. If you listen to Hillary, she's kind of a chameleon. From state to state, she'll change her position on gun control. When she's in Pennsylvania, she talks about hunting, talks about, you know, I did this stuff, loved it. And she goes to some place like San Francisco or Chicago, and she talks about all the gun violence and talk about the rampant epidemic we have with all these mass shootings. And there's just too many guns out there. So it's really hard to tell, you know, what she really believes. But deep down, I mean, Hillary has supported, you know, some gun control measures that don't really get after the problem. They want to blame, you know, guns are killing people and that sort of thing, when that's really not actually the truth. It's not accurate. Of all the gun violence out there, there's a very, probably less than 1% or even lower that of guns that by law-abiding citizens that are involved in any kind of, you know, kind of gun violence. So that's not really the issue.
And she seems to, you know, it, as you mentioned, okay, if she's in Pennsylvania, she'll talk about hunting. The Second Amendment is not about hunting. A well-regulated militia points out the fact that there was an expectation when they wrote that, that all able-bodied males at that time, but at this point I'll say all able-bodied citizens, have a responsibility to protect the country and protect their community. And that's not hunting. You know, that's not why we are allowed to be and expected to be armed and trained. So I think, as you mentioned, she is saying what I think her constituents want to hear and avoiding the very necessity and reason for the Second Amendment's existence. Now, let me kind of segue a little bit to a reason why the well-regulated militia might need weapons to protect themselves. And that is the fact we don't have borders to speak of. And to the extent we do have borders, we seem to think that bringing immigrants from places where we can't tell who the good guys or the bad guys are, such as Syria, is a good idea. Again, that's a major Hillary position, but the immigration policy of the United States seems to be a major reason why the citizenry needs to protect itself.
Exactly right. And you look at, you know, currently we have something like 300 sanctuary cities and counties across the United States, all the major cities, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, L.A. And, you know, you had Kate Steinle that was murdered, you know, by a guy that had been deported like five different times. And so they're handcuffing, you know, the very laws that we have on the books that they're not being enforced, and they champion that sort of thing. So and then in the same breath, they want to talk about how they want to get the guns out of the hands of law-abiding Americans. And so there's an issue out there with Syria. I mean, that's Comey and Jay Johnson have come out and said, we can't vet these people, but we're bringing them in anyway. You've had some lawmakers that want to bring in 10 times the amount. Tammy Duckworth wants to bring in 100,000, not just 10,000. And it's been shown that just four of the 200 that were brought into Europe caused Brussels and Paris. So if you extrapolate that number, you figure we bring in 10,000, that's going to mean 100 for us. 100 would-be terrorists that are inside the United States and can cause a lot of damage. And you look how many, you know, two of them caused a lot of death in San Bernardino.
So now you bring up a good point when you mention sanctuary cities. I think let's go back to that and start with the fact that that is a defiance by local government of the laws that are designed to keep all of us safe. And first of all, we are a federal republic, okay? Their states' rights are a major issue, and we believe that the states are the incubators of and the laboratory for democracy, and all those things are true. But there's a difference between the states trying ideas and then those filtering out to other folks once they're proven to work, and the states or cities deciding that they're simply going to not enforce laws that need to be enforced nationwide in order for all of us to be safe. So if immigrants and illegals of any kind know they have safe haven, then those cities are responsible for putting the rest of us at risk.
Absolutely. And it's I believe it's even worse than that. I mean, in my mind, people that don't, and mayors and whatnot of these cities that don't enforce the law should be indicted. I mean, simple as that. I mean, it's gotten so bad in the United States that we celebrate it. You have Bernie Sanders that has an undocumented immigrant that's on his staff. You saw the other day this gentleman by the name of Jose Antonio Vargas. He's probably one of the most well-known undocumented immigrants, and he's got a TV show on MTV. So we're celebrating people that are undocumented. You've got people that have gotten into the law school, that are applying for the bar, that are still not American, you know, naturalized American citizens. I mean, it's absolutely insane to me. But yeah, you can go on Google and go on illegal immigrant crime, and there's story after story after story after sons, daughters, and individuals that are being killed by immigrants. And we still think that, you know, it's our problem. We're racist, we're bigots, because we want a border, we want to secure the homeland against, you know, people that are just willing to come across the border, don't give any mind to our laws. They want the welfare, they want the handouts, and all this other kind of stuff. And you know, it's not just great people that want to work across the border that are coming across the border. It's criminals, it's, you know, drug cartels. They're bringing all kinds of poisons into our country, and it is a national security problem.
Folks, we're talking with Michael Anderson, who is a retired U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer who now writes for the Western Free Press. So what do we do? I mean, you mentioned one thing. I think it is legitimate to consider indicting those in a sanctuary city are the leadership who are promulgating that idea and putting it into practice. What else can we do as far as fixing the influx of folks who we absolutely have no idea who they are?
Well, it's a difficult problem, no doubt. I mean, the federal government has been bringing in immigrants from these disparate countries, Somalia, Iraq, and for several years now. I think the first thing we have to do is we have to secure the border. Now, whether that's Donald Trump's wall or, you know, increased border patrol, I mean, we have laws on the books. I mean, I think a great start would be we secure the border and we enforce the laws that are on the books. We force these sanctuary cities. Back in late 2015, there was a bill that was put in front of the Senate to cut off the funding. I mean, that's a great way to do it because certainly politicians all love money. You cut off the money to these cities that are sanctuary cities. And I think that's a great start in order to weed this problem out. But honestly, I think the last thing you want to do, we'll bring in, you have illegal immigrants, and some estimates are 12 million, some are 30, and you're bringing in Syrian refugees that you can't vet. And in the same breath, these politicians want to attack the Second Amendment. To me, it's absolutely ludicrous that you want to disarm law-abiding citizenry when you have this absolute threat that you're championing as an act of love, it just doesn't seem just logical to me.
It's also counter-constitutional, and that's the advantage we have, is we are still, whatever else we are a constitutional republic, and because of that, we will maintain our rights and fight for them every day. Folks, we've been talking with Michael Anderson, retired Marine Corps officer and writer at the Western Free Press. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Well, that's going to wrap up the show for today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow. This is Jim Hansen, and you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.